the Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. It was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi who greenlit the impeachment inquiry, but it's been L.A. Congressman Adam Schiff taking the brunt of President Trump's ire. We'll hear how much of that Schiff may have brought upon himself. Plus, looking for a unique new spot to get some grub in L.A.? Find out where to go for the nation's first ever cannabis cafe. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. The entire radio station is abuzz getting ready for the KPCC LAist open house on Sunday. You still have time to RSVP. Just go to LAist.com. That's LAIST.com. Coming up, we're going to visit the first cannabis cafe in the country. It opened this week in West Hollywood. That story coming up in about half an hour, so stay with us. But we're going to kick things off this Friday with some state of affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week,
this is a fraudulent crime on the American people, but we'll work together with Shifty Shift and Pelosi and all of them.
President Trump takes aim at California's Adam Schiff as the impeachment inquiry heats up. Meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom issues a bleak warning to California. We're going to get into those stories and more with two of our favorite analysts. Jack Pitney is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome back, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Also with us for a special State of Affairs this week, Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab also at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome to you, Zach.
Happy Friday, eh? Great to be here.
It's like being on in the faculty lounge at Claremont McKenna College. Okay, so Zach, let's start with you. President Trump has directed much of his impeachment ire at House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff, especially after the New York Times reported that he got an early account of the whistleblower's concerns. Is it uncommon for someone in Adam Schiff's position, the Intelligence Committee Chair, to hear complaints ahead of time?
Well, since we're in the faculty lounge, I'll talk a little bit about American institutions and say, you know, I think one of the emerging dynamics of this in terms of strategy is trying to make this partisan as possible, to make it look like everybody's not objective, that the whole thing is really about it, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, when in actuality, you know, there's real institutional concerns here. Yeah. Congress has broad oversight powers that are protected as part of the Constitution and part of the logic of checks and balances. So the idea that someone in the administration that would have a concern about malfeasance would approach a committee in the House is I say that's not really a problem. In fact, I think that's the way things are supposed to work. So that he gets a little early knowledge about this, that the whistleblower would make this a stop on his journey to express his concerns about what's happening is institutionally, I think, is not a problem. I think where it starts to break down is if you try to make this look like nothing more than rather than a sort of, you know, principled process about the executive and the Congress, if you make this look at Shifty Shift and Donald Trump, and we all know about, you know, what partisans they all are, and, you know, is there double dealing? Is this a secret deal on the side? Then you start to sort of cast a shadow on the idea that Congress is involved. But it's not unusual or, I think, improper that that Congress, again, was a sort of stop on the whistleblower's journey.
Because, Zach, the way the president and put it, he said, I wouldn't be surprised if he helped them write the complaint.
Well, you know, Schiff's in a tough position because everyone sort of knows Donald Trump. It's all baked in the cake. They know he's going to say a lot of things. He's going to do a lot of things. And people have their minds pretty much made up, although maybe the ground's shifting a little bit. But Adam Schiff, he has to be like Caesar's wife, above suspicion. You know, he's got to work harder than Donald Trump does to prove, you know, this negative that he's not a partisan, that this isn't, you know, a Mueller-style witch hunt. So he's got a higher standard to live up to. And, you know, I think we'll talk a little further about some of the revelations that have come out about Schiff's conduct thus far. And, you know, things like that coming out poke holes to this idea that, you know, he's being objective, the objective institutionalist doing his constitutional duty. He's really got to work hard to avoid the appearance of being a partisan.
But Jack Pitney, there are other Democrats involved in this. Nancy Pelosi, she kicked off the impeachment inquiry. You got Gerald Nadler, who heads the House Judiciary Committee. Any thoughts as to why the president is targeting Adam Schiff?
He sees Schiff as a potential big threat for a couple of reasons. First, Schiff not only was a federal prosecutor, but he has experience in prosecuting counterintelligence cases. So he has far more expertise in these things than most members of Congress. Second, this hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but he was a House manager in the two most recent impeachments, both of federal judges about a decade ago. So he knows this process inside and out. And to follow on what Zach said, that also makes his missteps in dealing with public disclosure and the things he said about that all the more puzzling. He should have known better.
Now, the Washington Post detailed some of Congressman Schiff's more perplexing decisions during this inquiry so far. Received flack over how he paraphrased the Ukraine call during the House Intelligence Committee hearing last week. And on a recent TV interview, he said the Intelligence Committee had not previously spoken to the whistleblower. That was not true, and his office later clarified his remarks. Zach, do missteps like that hurt impeachment, or at least hurt the optics of the impeachment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it hurts the optics, certainly. Like I said, Schiff's got to be like Caesar's wife above suspicion. He can't be seen as being not objective in this. We want him to be this sort of, gray, objective, lawyerly figure that's a contrast to Donald Trump, talking to reporters and sort of letting his id fly. Schiff's got to perform at a higher standard. And so little missteps like this, I agree with Jack, are perplexing, and they certainly do not serve the cause either of the investigation or the impeachment.
Jack, President Trump has tried to coin a nickname for Nancy Pelosi. It hasn't really stuck. Why do you think he has not been as critical about her? Is it the power she wields, maybe fear, possibly?
All of the above. He is afraid of Schiff in certain respects, but he's come to understand how formidable an opponent Nancy Pelosi is. And he also does have a history. He's not always been very self-aware about this, of attacking women. So perhaps he may be a little more cautious in her case.
Now, Pelosi and Adam Schiff seem to take different approaches to their media appearance. Adam Schiff is often on TV. He sends out press releases or news releases all the time about all kinds of things. He talks to us here on Take Two. Nancy Pelosi doesn't talk to us much here. That's the way she does things. What does her media strategy, Jack, tell you about her leadership style?
Old school. This is somebody who is steeped in traditional politics. Her father was mayor of Baltimore. Her brother was mayor of Baltimore. She has been in politics literally since infancy. And so this is just how old school, old fashioned political leaders operate. You've got a couple of different models for the speakership. You have the very public speakership of Newt Gingrich, and then you have the more behind the scenes speakership of somebody like Sam Rayburn, and Nancy Pelosi is more in the latter category.
Now, that leads us to the latest news on House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and some statements made by White House officials today. They say they won't cooperate with the impeachment inquiry until a full House vote. Zach, what's the strategy behind that?
Well, Nancy, I agree. She's definitely old-style Paul. Her dad's deeply rooted in Baltimore politics, and she's very wise about politics. She's also an institutionalist, and she knows about Congress's powers to their oversight powers and their ability to investigate. And the Trump administration is putting out a red herring that somehow there hasn't been something done in the House of Representatives that allows them to conduct an investigation, which is just patently false. But it gives them a kind of legitimacy to say, oh, we don't actually have to respond because, look, the House isn't doing what they're supposed to do. And it's frankly kind of a disinformation campaign. I think Nancy's going to be very clear, very deliberate, very calm in saying, this is our institution. We're protecting it. Remember her initial speech about this where she had lots of flags behind her and she was quoting the founders. And she's making this about a sort of high-minded institutional process. She's not going to let this descend into kind of mere politics. And I think that's the role she's playing.
It's almost like a masterclass in being deliberate in a lot of ways, Jack.
That's right. And for months, the more progressive wing of the party was very critical of her. Why are you waiting? Why are you waiting? Well, now we see why she was waiting. Politically, it was very smart for her to wait to get more evidence and more ammunition before she moved ahead.
talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Zach Corser, he co-directs the Policy Lab also at Claremont McKenna College. Also at the heart of this entire inquiry is the person the whistleblower says the president is out to get, and that's Joe Biden. But at events in San Francisco this week, he all but ignored the issue. Zach, what kind of strategy do you see Joe Biden deploying here? Because he's in the crosshairs a bit. He's involved, but he's not, but he is. So what do you think?
Look, Joe's in a tough position because, you know, he's running in a competitive race for the nomination on the Democratic side. And it's sort of a divide and conquer for Donald Trump. Donald Trump, I think, in many ways has won it politically in the sense that, you know, Ukraine's prosecutor is going to do an audit of his son and the case there. The onus is now on Joe to respond to Trump, while all the other campaigns can focus on doing other things like raising money, talking about their own issues. You know, Joe was a bit wobbly to begin with. You know, he's maybe been doing a little better. He's kind of holding steady in the polls, but he's always been a little bit behind where people would like him to be to really seem like the competitor to Donald Trump. And I think Donald Trump, in his strategy of putting it out there that there's something wrong with Biden, I think it's done enough to really strongly damage Biden's campaign. And I don't think Biden alone can really turn that ship around. And the House can't afford to weigh in on this on Joe's side in a political manner. The other candidates, there's no real political motivation for them to circle the wagons for Biden because they'd like to see him gone as well. So, I mean, you know, I don't know what Joe exactly is supposed to say. He's in a really tough spot.
Is he just weathering the storm, Jack, or is he trying to do the Don Draper change the conversation thing?
Well, he's trying to join the conversation that lots of ordinary voters want to have. Once you get beyond the real hardcore activists, voters want to hear about things such as health care, want to hear about the economy. He's tried to do some of that, but he hasn't done it as effectively as he could have. In fact, he was talking to the service employees just today, and there was some pushback that he hadn't been specific enough on developing a plan for unions, a plan for the economy, and that's something he needs to address.
All right, moving on, Zach. Governor Gavin Newsom issued what some might call a bleak warning Thursday, talking about California's economy. He used an airplane analogy, saying we're about to begin our descent. considering we always hear about the California economy, and if it were its own country, it would be the fifth largest in the world. What factors do you think he's looking at?
Fasten your seatbelts, put your tray tables up. You know, California is very sensitive to the growth in the economy because a lot of its revenues come in through income tax. And so, you know, the good times are really good and the bad times are really bad. And if America and California inevitably would have to, if these are larger, you know, macroeconomic forces fall into recession, it's going to have a major impact on revenues. And, you know, we've had some really good times for a long time here in California. And we have a rainy day fund to help. But things can get really bad. And I think the rainy day fund's at about $19 billion now out of about a $20 billion budget. So it's a nice cushion, but I think it's sort of a signal that, look, you know, we might not be able to help everyone all the time. Don't expect you know, the percentage of spending to go up in the next fiscal year. You know, let's start thinking about tightening our belts a little bit. And I think that's realistic.
Jack, quickly, what do you see?
As Mr. T said in Rocky III, pain. As Zach said, it's an old economic expansion, and the trade war is bringing it to a rapid close.
Jack Pitney is a Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab also at Claremont McKenna College. Jack and Zach, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, A.
All right, you've heard the phrase, I don't know if I'm coming or going. Well, if you are in an Uber or Lyft by a terminal at LAX, then soon you'll definitely only be getting dropped off and not getting picked up. Coming up, why you might not want to turn down a ride home from the airport if someone offers. Find out what changes are arriving at LAX that could clog up your arrival off the plane when Take Two continues right about 60 seconds from now. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon announced his resignation yesterday. He said he plans to move to Los Angeles, where he's expected to run for office against L.A.'s District Attorney Jackie Lacey. For more on this expected race to lead the nation's largest jail system, we have Marisa Lagos, political correspondent with KQED. Hi, Marisa.
Hey, how are you?
Good. All right. So before we get into Gascon's future, let's take a step back and look at his career in law enforcement. What was he doing before he became San Francisco's DA?
Gascon was actually came up through the police world. He was a longtime Los Angeles Police Department officer and was in leadership there before. I think he kind of saw the writing on the wall and decided that he wasn't going to necessarily get to be a chief in L.A. And so he ended up moving to Mesa, Arizona, and kind of made a national name for himself in some ways there, really taking on former Maricopa Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Gascon, whose parents are Cuban immigrants, really stood up to him. And at the time, even though Gascon was still a Republican, I think sort of started burnishing these progressive credentials by being an outspoken critic of the sheriff at a time when you weren't hearing a lot of that necessarily within Arizona from law enforcement. And so actually when Kamala Harris was elected to be the Attorney General of California, then Mayor Gavin Newsom appointed Gascon as the police chief in San Francisco. So really until he became DA, he was a police officer, and that's really where his background is.
All right, so let's go to San Francisco then. What did Gascon accomplish there, and what have critics and supporters said about his time as DA?
It was interesting when he was tapped to be the district attorney. It was a bit of a surprise. But even before that, there was a lot of pushback internally when he became the police chief, the police officers union here, who were pretty conservative even by other city standards, were very angry that Newsom had appointed someone like Gascon who didn't come up through the department. And so when Newsom named him DA, I think there was a lot of hope and optimism among folks who really liked the things that Gascon was talking about. He went on to be a really big supporter of some of the broad criminal justice reforms that we've seen both voters and lawmakers embrace in recent years. And he often did that sort of in opposition to his colleagues within the district attorney and law enforcement community. So he was one of the only DAs supporting things like Prop 47, which made a lot of felonies misdemeanors. He really pushed some of the sentencing reforms that we've seen in recent years. And he was on board for things like pushing automatic expungement. So he was the first prosecutor in the nation to create a program where after marijuana was legalized here in California, his office would basically go into the system and do the legwork to make sure that people who had convictions that could get cleared from the past, that would happen automatically. And so among national and sort of statewide reformers, he's really been held up as this progressive kind of example of what a DA can do.
So does he have a mixed kind of reputation if you go national as opposed to local?
Absolutely. And I think that that's what's really interesting here. You know, I think broadly, to be fair to Gascon, it's a lot easier to talk about and support policy changes than it is to implement them. I think within San Francisco, he had a couple of problems. One was that challenge implementing, these reforms. And I think sometimes critics would say that it was a result of his sort of lacking management experience. I think there was a core group of people around him that really trust him and like him. And I don't know that he was ever able to build that constituency throughout the entire DA's office or really throughout the city. You know, we in San Francisco have like liberal Democrats and more liberal Democrats. But he wasn't really part of either group, the more moderate San Franciscans or the more progressive ones. Newsom obviously was close with him, but when he left to become lieutenant governor, I think that kind of left Gascon without a real sort of champion in City Hall. And so I think that that was a challenge for him. And then I also think think that, you know, there were situations, for example, around police shootings. The Black Lives Matter movement really has taken to the streets here and called out Gascon for what they see as his lack of leadership in prosecuting police officers. Again, the story is a little more complicated because in at least one of those cases, Gascon came out and said, hey, I would like to prosecute this person. I just don't think I can under the current law. And so in situations like that, he kind of just made everybody mad, right? And so, you know, I think that this speaks to a wide range of things, but the political savviness you need to be a DA extends beyond, right, whether you can implement policy in your own office. It's leadership, it's management of a team of very different lawyers, but it's also being able to advocate your position at City Hall for resources and getting people on your side. And I think he did struggle with that.
Now, some criminal reform activists have been trying to get him to run here in L.A. against Jackie Lacey. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they see an opportunity here. Again, you know, he's from L.A. He does have ties there. I think, you know, Jackie Lacey has a lot of very strong Democratic credentials and endorsements. But I think she's largely seen by people, liberal Democrats, as a sort of typical law and order prosecutor, and that they would like to see somebody bring some of these newer ideas and embrace some of these reforms. And I think that, again, given the sort of profile Gascon has had as a state leader, they feel like this is a really good opportunity when you add up sort of his law enforcement background with those credentials.
Gascon says his last day in office is October 18th. The deadline to enter the LA race is early December. So there is a time component involved here. Marisa Lagos is a political correspondent with KQED. Marisa, thanks for the time.
Always a pleasure.
Since February, 125 people from low-income neighborhoods in Stockton have been getting a monthly cash boost. No strings attached. The 18-month experiment hopes to find solutions to the income inequalities plaguing the city and our state. As part of our California Dream collaboration, Capital Public Radio's Sammy Kayola reports that for the first time, data is out on how that money is being spent.
On the 15th of every month, $500 show up on Jovan Bravo's debit card. He says it changes the way he approaches the family budget.
It's a good feeling, knowing that we have the extra little bit of income.
The 31-year-old construction worker says the stipend has made buying school clothes and other staples for his three kids a little easier. Since he started receiving the money, he's cut his 68-hour work week down to about 50 hours.
It's been great. Get to spend a lot more time with the kids. I'm able to pick them up from school. Able to do a lot more things on the weekend instead of always being tired.
The local organization running the experiment handpicked our subject for this story. Bravo is a member of their, quote, storytelling cohort. He's a guinea pig for a concept called universal basic income, a fixed stipend that people can spend as they choose. Supporters see it as a replacement, or at least a supplement, for a broken welfare system. Several presidential candidates are running on some version of this. Here's Kamala Harris.
Almost half of American families are a $400 unexpected expense away from complete upheaval. And so I'm proposing that we give them a lift up.
And Andrew Yang.
My flagship proposal is the freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for every American adult starting at age 18.
Critics worry people will use the money to buy drugs and alcohol, or that they'll stop working altogether. Proponents say a little financial security could inspire people to start businesses and seek education. The first data to come out of the Stockton experiment shows recipients are spending roughly 40% of the money on food, followed by clothing and home goods and then utilities. The data does not include cash expenditures from the debit card. But UC Berkeley economist Jesse Rothstein says pilots like the one in Stockton aren't the most accurate tool for predicting behavior because people won't make major life changes when the income bump is temporary.
They just can't be transformative at this scale. You'd have to scale them up by many orders of magnitude to have the kinds of impacts people are talking about, and nobody has figured out how to pay for that.
Outside Stockton City Hall, cars rush by on their morning commute. It's a diverse city. Fewer than half of residents are white. It's also a place trying to reinvent itself. A decade ago, it was known as America's foreclosure capital, and still more than one in five residents live in poverty. The city's mayor, 29-year-old Michael Tubbs, wants to see a renaissance. He's planning major beautification projects downtown. Inside his office at City Hall, Tubbs explains he's trying to change the look and reputation of the city while giving some of the people here a hand up.
It's just all about breaking cycles of poverty and increasing the amount of opportunity for everyone.
The mayor is acting as a front man for the experiment, but the city isn't footing the bill. The $3 million it takes to run the program comes from a private foundation pushing for universal basic income.
For so long, people have looked at Stockton for examples of when things are bad. But this is one of a couple of examples where now people are looking at Stockton for solutions.
Jovan Bravo is a Stockton native. He grew up poor and he has a criminal record, but he wants his kids to have a different life.
Stockton, it's a very dangerous city at times. So I try to keep my kids out of the streets and studying in school and stay busy in extracurricular activities.
That's why some of his monthly deposit goes to sports camps and gymnastics classes. When the pilot ends, he'll go back to working Saturdays to keep up with those expenses. Stockton is one of two cities with a basic income pilot underway. In Stockton, I'm Sammy Kayola.
If you use rideshare apps during pickup at LAX, listen up. Things are about to change. Drop-offs will still be allowed curbside at the terminals, but pickup locations will be moved to a new staging area called LA Exit. It's going to have restrooms, benches, Wi-Fi, cell phone charging stations, even food trucks. Now, to get there, well, you're going to have to walk a little bit or maybe take a shuttle. LA Exit will be located just east of Terminal 1 at the corner of Worldway and Skyway. The new pickup system will take effect October 29th and will stay in service through 2023 when the new LAX People Mover opens up to transport travelers into and out of the airport more efficiently. Now, if you've been to LAX recently, you've probably experienced the lane closures that are slowing things down. Well, the People Mover is the reason why. It's under construction right now, and it's part of the reason for the change. The other reason is one we know all too well, and that's traffic. More Take Two coming right up. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Earlier this week, the country's first cannabis cafe opened in West Hollywood. It's called Lowell Farms, and it's a departure from what people might expect from a restaurant whose whole shtick is that you can light up while eating. So, being the first of its kind, we wanted to know what the experience is like and what to expect. We sent KPCC's Leo Duran to take a tour and see it firsthand.
So excited.
Very excited. So I am here with my friend Cambra Moniz Edwards. This is actually my very first year ever trying marijuana, so I'm not very well versed in what to do. I brought you here along because you're sort of my Sherpa.
I am a cannabis consumer, maybe getting to connoisseur status. And I've been following Lowell Farms on social media for a little while, and I've been excited about the opening of the cafe, so I'm very curious to see how it's all laid out, how they recommend different strains.
Wow, there's a lot of greenery in the outside. Plants. No, weed. It's plants. How are you guys?
Hi.
Cool, here you go. So this is part of the process. We have to check IDs on the way in.
Yeah. They,
just like going to a dispensary.
Exactly.
Okay. As we're walking in, wow, this building just feels lush. It almost feels like I'm in a museum that's just filled with potted plants everywhere. There's a lot of wood and this nice parquet flooring as well, too.
You want to sit over in
the
corner?
Oh, corner's perfect. Yeah, that's great.
That's fine.
Everything's very rattan and kind of vintage feeling.
I mean, it's really evoking all this being outside in nature. Also, as we're here, it's actually kind of weird to be in a restaurant and see like mini ashtrays on the table. I'm so used to being in no smoking places.
Everything old is new again.
Yeah, this is a little odd. Although this ashtray, wow, it is like inlaid with a bull on the inside.
Yeah, everything has
quite a bit of detail. Matchbook is branded, the ashtray is branded and inlaid, like you said, like everything has that little kind of extra finishing touch on it. Now you're looking at the food menu.
Yeah, I guess there's a bud tender who's going to be coming by, or a flower tender, as they put it. And also, hold on, there's also another
that
booklet
must be
on our table.
Menu.
Instead of a wine list, this is most definitely the weed list. So cold-pressed cannabis oil, you can get Lowell Pax Pot, pink lemonade, Era and Lowell Pod Combo, creme brulee sauce. These, even though they sound like food, it's most definitely the names of their weed strains.
Is it describing the strains to you?
Yeah, it's doing what I've seen in coffee shops where they describe it in three words. So like in a coffee shop, the beans will be like earthy, jammy, cranberries. Here's some examples over the Farm Fresh selection. Happy, relaxed, euphoric, invigorating, active.
Oh, this is interesting. It also tells you how quickly you can expect to feel high and how long you will be high for. So yeah, check this out.
Onset immediate, duration 1 to 4 hours. That's for all the pre-roll singles. On the candies, they have chocolate squares, wild gummies, spelled with a Y, W-Y-L-D.
That's how you know they're good. Oh, they have infused beverages. Hi.
Are you our server?
My name is Lisa.
So welcome. I got so many questions about how this works.
So with me, you order all of the food.
Okay.
And then I will bring a flower host over here, and then you guys order all the weed good stuff from her.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll bring her right over, and you guys can order the weed from her, and then I will come back and take your guys' food order, okay?
Okay. Hi.
Are you our flower host?
Shay, your flower host.
Hi.
Nice to meet you, Shay. I'm Leo.
Nice to meet you, Leo.
Hi, I'm Cambra.
Nice to meet you, Cambra.
Me too.
Well, I'm here to handle all your flower needs, girls and guys. I'm the connoisseur of weed, so the sommelier.
Perfect. I will say I'm very, very curious about this Space Coyote hash pre-roll.
Oh, yeah. Those are top of the line, top shelf weed, and they are like have hash in it, so it's going to be woo.
So we're here at like a nice, bright, sunny day for lunch. I'm having fun with my friends, so let's just imagine like this day continues and I don't have to go back to work.
Let's do a hybrid for you. The black gelato, it's going to give you both the uplifting in the head, then also the body high of an indica.
I have a question about, I'm just looking through the back of the menu. And looking at some of the concentrates, are these cartridges? Are they dabs?
No, yes. So they will be considered dabs. There's no cartridge.
Okay.
We're not on the vape path anymore.
Got it.
So, yes.
Why not on the vape path?
Just with everything going on in the media and the news.
So for now, it's a safety precaution based on the worries that there are about vaping.
Right, and we don't want to worry our customers, so we just stay away from the vapes right now.
Got it.
You guys ready to order some snacks?
We need your recommendations about what to order, considering the two of us have already ordered our weed strains.
I would say maybe something cold, so like a salad.
I was actually thinking of the banh mi.
Yeah, do you want to get the vegan banh mi or the regular banh mi? Honestly, the vegan banh mi is really good. It's a cauliflower.
Let's go vegan today. I'll do a vegan banh mi.
All right.
Yes, can I do the vegan nachos, please?
The vegan nachos, you got it.
So, I have the black gelato for you, and then we have the Space Cowboy pre-rolled sativa for you.
Thank you.
Because we're outside and the music is nice and soft, there's a lot of green around here. This is like really relaxing, I will say.
Yeah, I think they've made a real effort to make it feel like somewhere you want to linger. I can definitely say that when I was in high school smoking pot, I never thought it would be like this. Now I consume with my mother. I've always preferred marijuana to alcohol. I don't like feeling hungover. I don't like the feeling of losing control if you imbibe too much.
Right.
Like you said, if you consume too much marijuana, you're probably just gonna overeat and fall asleep.
Enjoy.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Wow, that looks good.
Yeah, and you already have your nachos here. Okay, these vegan nachos are pretty good though.
Yeah?
Yeah, like the vegan cheese sauce, it's on point. Oh, wow. This vegan banh mi is really good. Whatever they use to season the cauliflower itself, It's so flavorful. It's a little bit sweet with just very, very touch of heat. Regardless of the weed part, the food part I'm kind of impressed by.
I didn't expect it to be good, I'll be honest.
What were you really expecting?
I thought it would be just okay.
They're gonna like just bring us a bag of Doritos and say like, here you go, $12. So we saw the desserts. We want some desserts.
Okay. I'm a chocolate girl.
And I'm an ice cream girl.
So. One of each.
All right, we're gonna share the Mexican chocolate sundae. Okay, so dessert's not here yet, but we have something a little bit better. Andrea Drummer, who's the executive chef here. I mean, how do you figure out what these best pair with in terms of weed?
When I was first inspired to infuse food, it was because I was smelling the flavor profile of this California Blue Dream. And it wanted to be something other than a brownie.
Okay. What did it end up being?
It ended up being bruschetta. I just let it speak to me and tell me what it wants to be.
What does this experience mean to you? Because this seems sort of different than the traditional idea of where I imagine people doing marijuana in the first place.
We want it to just be a normal thing. If you were to go to a restaurant and have a glass of wine, as casual as that, we really want to normalize the idea of cannabis consumption.
Well, thanks a lot. Our dessert is currently melting in the sun right now.
Yes, please.
And thanks for taking the time and having us over.
Enjoy, please. Yeah. Thank you.
Now that my meal is complete, I might
walk around.
Light back up.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran with his friend Cambra Moniz Edwards giving you a firsthand experience of Lowell Farms, the country's first cannabis restaurant located in West Hollywood. And to clarify, while they do serve edibles, the restaurant food itself does not contain cannabis. Now, we have a guide to Lowell Farms online at our website, las.com. There you'll see pictures of the space, the food, and the cannabis. That's laist.com. All right, true crime, anything, whether it's a TV show, book, or podcast, can be a serious dive into a rabbit hole. Once you start, impossible to stop. But have you ever considered using the skills you have or don't have to help police solve crimes? There's a book that shows you how. Find out in 60 seconds. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Covering heinous crimes, reporters often become jaded or dejected. But journalist Billy Jensen refused to go down that path. Instead of just writing about cold cases, he decided to help solve the crimes himself, including the mystery of the Golden State Killer, who committed more than a dozen murders, at least 50 rapes, and 100 burglaries in California during the 70s and 80s. Chase Darkness With Me is Jensen's memoir, which details his transformation from reporter to the world's first digital consulting detective. He joins me now. Billy, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a background in digital news, monitoring sites for page views, social media content. How did that give you the tools you needed to investigate, even though technically you are not a detective?
You know, I was a newspaper veteran. I became the digital guy at the newspaper. So I would be the guy that would be, okay, we're going to start this website. We're going to start these blogs. We're going to do these slideshows. Meanwhile, at night, I was writing crime stories. And the thing about my crime stories is that I made a very conscious decision early on in my career that I would only write about unsolved cases, which is the reason why I didn't become a crime beat reporter. And you would try to push the case along, but at the end of the day, no matter how good of a writer you are, you're writing a story with no ending. And I just had this kind of epiphany one night. I was watching this video of a guy getting attacked. And I was like, why can't they get this guy? This video is so clear. And then I realized it's not a matter of when there were five television stations in a city and two newspapers, and that's where everybody got their news. People were all over the place. And I said, you know what? I know how to get people's attention on social media. Let me try this idea out, geo-targeting campaigns towards people within that neighborhood.
All right, so you're building that skill set. Now, after the sudden death of the widely respected true crime author and your close friend, Michelle McNamara, then her husband, Patton Oswalt, reached out to you and Paul Haynes to help finish her book about the Golden State Killer, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. What did it mean to you to have such a big task entrusted to you?
It's actually kind of the other way around. I wrote a tribute to her because everybody was calling her Patton Oswalt's wife. I was like, no, she's Michelle McNamara, true crime writer, and that's what I wanted to do. So I published that on my blog, and I had written in that story, I said, I'll do anything I can to get this book out. And then when I spoke to Patton that weekend, I said, what's the one thing I can do here to help after this awful, awful tragedy? And it's like, I can get this book out. I knew two things. I knew it was going to be great because she's an amazing writer, and I knew how hard she worked on it. What I brought is kind of putting all the pieces together because she had written it, not chronologically, kind of wrote it in chunks. The fact that it came out and was a success, and then 2 months later, Paul Holes, who I do a podcast with now called The Murder Squad, the fact that he caught him, you know, but the book was already out, was big sigh of relief to actually get the book out.
Tell us, though, about when the news broke that he was caught.
You know, you're going through these range of emotions, and you're also trying to figure out if it's real or not. We were all kind of trading information, looking up things and looking up on newspapers.com, just trying to see, like, you know, and it unfolded with me then calling around and talking to a survivor and her saying, yeah, it's not only a press conference, they have somebody in custody. And that was the, oh, wow, moment of, I can't believe that. When I got the name, my heart kind of deflated a little bit because we had done our own DNA analysis when we only had the Y chromosome stuff with the DNA. We did it in this thing called Y Search. And we got a hit once. It said it was going to be of English or Germanic descent. So when I heard the name D'Angelo, I thought, oh, you know, we always thought Italian. But then, you know, you're doing searches for his name in newspapers.com, and then you learn things like, oh, he was a cop. And then it's like, wow, we always kind of thought he might have been a cop. And then you learn that he was fired from being a cop for shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. And that was the, oh my God, this is him. And that's the, and you can see right now, I still get goosebumps. And I
can confirm. I see the goosebumps.
You can see the goosebumps. I know this is the theater of the mind, but yeah.
We're talking to crime reporter and author Billy Jensen about his memoir, Chase Darkness With Me. All right. Now, some journalists practice some distance with their subjects and report on developments by not inserting themselves in cases. That is not what you do. Have you faced criticism from colleagues, from other people in journalism about getting involved in cold cases?
No, I don't even really consider myself necessarily a journalist anymore. I really am more of a victim's advocate because I am working with the police, closely with the police in some cases. I want that.
Because, I mean, I'm asking because the appetite for true crime, whether it's fictional or true, things like Dateline and other shows like that, people eat this stuff up, Billy. I mean, it's so popular. It's off-putting to some people, but for the people that love it, they really, really love it. What do you think it says about us?
It's setting some type of order out of some type of disorder, something that's foreign that wasn't supposed to happen. That was, you bring up Dateline. Dateline is a perfect example. It always starts out, beautiful community. She had a smile that lit up a room, all those tropes. And then you go into, it gets dark, something bad happens, and then it gets fixed. And that's why people like the ones that are solved. And I think now with podcasts, we're able to do unsolved stories with podcasts that television would never touch. Ever.
Now, when it comes to the term armchair detective, it's a term been around a long time. I think it's heightened right now with all the true crime stuff out there right now. What do these folks do and what impact do they have on solving crimes?
Well, I use the term citizen detective more than armchair detective. One of the things that they do that have been successful is matching up unidentified remains with missing persons. Biggest blind spot for investigative law enforcement is that we have 18,000, 19,000 different police departments and law enforcement agencies. All of their information doesn't talk to each other. There's not one database for every murder that has ever happened in America.
Well, you mentioned the relationship with the police when it comes to citizen detectives.
Yeah.
What is that like? Because do police want the help?
They should want the help. The citizens have to know that it's a one-way street. You're not going to get anything back from them. And you're not going to probably get credit. I've been able to get credit a couple times, and it was amazing. I never thought I would, but they're not going to be like, oh, I found this too, and start trading information with you.
You mentioned how it's a citizen detective. I'm wondering, because we hear the term community policing a lot, but could this be a form of community policing where people with this particular set of skills that are willing to help out an understaffed and undersourced police department, you think they could work together like this in that way?
One of the things that I would love to see is there are so many police files, even ones that are only 10 years old, that are still handwritten, having somebody go in and digitize those.
Wow. Yeah,
you know,
that awesome,
sort of
right?
stuff. Yeah. And I've asked cops, and I said, what would be the one thing that you'd want citizens to do? And they've all said that. We talked about that on Murder Squad, and we literally got, I think the number's up to like 350 people who have written in saying, I want to do it. How do I do it?
You that's
know?
Awesome.
So
I would
it's
think
there.
It's,
yeah.
it's not a sexy thing, right?
No,
so
no, no, but
people
know,
do want to do it.
People would
wow,
do it. Yeah. Awesome. And what I would like is just one or two police departments just to give it a shot.
People read your book. They put it down. What do you hope that they get out of it? What do you hope is in their brain simmering?
You know, I hope that they would give it to somebody who is in law enforcement, to be honest with you. And then I've had so many people reach out to me and say, a friend went missing and they started using the system and they were able to find him, which was amazing. Things like that are happening. You know, we've got this case. We started using your system and everything, which is great. And any cop, any detective that wants to just have an idea, go on my website, who wants to use this system, you know, either I can help or I can, you know, lay out the groundwork of how to do it.
If you think you have what it takes to be a citizen detective, find out about the system in Chase Darkness With Me. That's the new memoir from crime reporter and author Billy Jensen. Billy, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Finally, the weekend is around the corner, so if you're looking for something to do, we have your guide.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, back from that Cannabis Cafe. Autumn is here. That means cool in the mornings and warm in the afternoons, and I've got ideas on how to make your weekend fire.
All right, starting with what?
Okay, so I will admit, I love this weather. I am LA's sweatiest person,
you?
Probably. Oh yeah, I sweat so badly.
Wow.
And when fall comes, I'm in heaven. And because it's fall, it's time for pumpkins. So tomorrow and Sunday, Cal Poly Pomona in Pomona hosts the grand opening of its annual Pumpkin Fest. Thousands of pumpkins will be on sale for $5 each. Plus, there will be all kinds of activities to enjoy, like hay rides, pony rides, corn mazes, which I'm an expert at, by the way. And the fest continues on until Halloween, and entry starts at $3.
All right, so then now what's going on for our friends in Orange County?
Over in Santa Ana, there's a celebration for the Indian Festival of Lights, Diwali. On Sunday, the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana hosts an event with performances by bands and dancers throughout the day. Plus, there'll be free Indian sweets and face painting, plus a special sale of Tibetan rugs. When you go, it comes with the price of admission to the museum itself, which starts at $12. But here's a special treat. If you're museum member or are a Santa Ana resident, then it's all free.
All right. Last event, a little close to home for us.
Right, right. So, Angelinos out there, have you ever lived in LA and always wanted a guaranteed chance to meet celebrities in real life? Well, then how about celebrities like Larry Mantle, John Horn, A. Martinez himself? Yeah. This Sunday is KPCC's annual open house in Pasadena. You'll be able to see how we make radio and podcasts, plus stories for our site, LAIS. And if you ever wanted to be on air, you can actually sign up to record a testimonial in our studios. That's where you hear people say, I'm blah, 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 and here's why I love KPCC. That can actually be you, which we do air. There will also be some interviews that people like you will be hosting, A. Martinez. And just like listening to KPCC, coming by is free, but if you wanted a free tote bag, remember to RSVP. Now, that's not all. The KPCC LAIS gang have more to share of what to do this weekend. Check it out on LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. And find me on Twitter, at Leo Has a Cat.
That's our own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks.
Au revoir.
One of those celebrities, John Horn, hosts The Frame each and every single day. Hey, John.
Discount celebrity, I think.
What's on the show today?
We have an interview with the composer of Joker. So if you're going to go see Joker, and I know you
we're
going to talk to her. We're going to listen to how she put together the music. And then come back on the weekend, not just for the open house, but for The Frame weekend. We have a great interview about cancel culture, about why comedians are targeted so heavily for what they've said in the past.
The Frame with John Horn, 3:30 Monday through Friday. The show on the weekends is Saturday too.
Saturday, you got that right.
And we're both going to be at the open house.
We'll see you
there. I can't
wait
to meet you. I want to meet a celebrity. All right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are The Birthday Girl, Lori Skywalker Galaretta, Leo Duran, and Gabriel Dunatoff. Austin Cross directs the show. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice. Our editor is Sue Carpenter. The program is engineered by Hazmik Pogosian, and Megan Larson is the senior producer. As always, you could find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two, at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at amartinezla. That's at amartinezla. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.